We've been discussing the last few weeks Rebbe's compilation of the Mishnah. And we discussed that Rabbi Akiva was a great sage who learned by Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Eliezer. If you recall, we discussed that Rabbi Eliezer is Rabbi Eliezer ben Hurkanus, who had, at age 27, he didn't know how to say Kriya Shema, he didn't know how to bench, he didn't know how to make a single blessing, he knew absolutely nothing. And he wanted to learn Torah, and his father Hurkanus, a wealthy Jew, said, at this age you don't start learning Torah. You get married, bring kids to the world, they'll learn Torah. And he didn't know why, but he had an inner yearning to go learn, and he left his father's wealth and went to Jerusalem. He had nothing to eat, he was eating grass. And he stayed by Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananya, a poor blacksmith, and he went to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who was chief rabbi at the time, and learned by him. And he really, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai didn't want to deal with him initially when he walked in. A guy walks in, he doesn't know anything, but he stood there and cried until Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai agreed every day to teach him two laws. And Rabbi Eliezer would come each day and learn them and memorize them and understand them until he knew them down pat. And that's how Rabbi Eliezer grew. And Rabbi Eliezer grew so much that he was Rabbi Yeshua's, ultimately he was his counterpart. Just like everyone knows the famous stories about Hillel and Shammai, how Hillel was so patient and Shammai was so strict, the letter of the law. Those same traits we find again between Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Eliezer, that they both learned by Rabbi Yochanan, who was a disciple of Hillel and Shammai. He was the small disciple of Hillel, but when Hillel was lying on his deathbed, Hillel said he should take the reign of princehood after me. And because Hillel's own son was too young, so Hillel said, my smallest student, from Yochanan ben Zakkai, and that's a concept in and of itself, needs discussion, why Hillel said he should be appointed as the Nasi. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was a disciple of Hillel's and Shammai's, but he became the Nasi after Hillel's passing, and Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua were his disciples. Now Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua, they had many disciples, one of which was Rabbi Akiva. And Rabbi Akiva, we have a recording that they were once sitting together and there was a discussion. Rabbi Yeshua said one way, Rabbi Eliezer said another way. Along came Rabbi Akiva, and he argued with both his rabbis, and he was proven right. And that's why we say Rabbi Akiva was a student of Rabbi Eliezer's and Rabbi Yeshua's, and yet he reached a level where he could argue with them. Now, let's just remind ourselves. We have Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, a disciple of Hillel and Shammai. He has five major disciples quoted in Pirkei Avos, right? Rabbi Eliezer ben Hurkanus, Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananya, Rabbi Yossi HaKohen, Rabbi Netanel, right? And Rabbi Elazar ben Arach. So his top disciple, one opinion says Rabbi Eliezer ben Hurkanus, the other opinion says Rabbi Elazar ben Arach. Rabbi Eliezer ben Hurkanus and Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananya, we saw that Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananya had the famous argument with the young Nasi, Rabbi Gamliel. And because of him, because of the way Rabbi Gamliel treated him, they removed Rabbi Gamliel from being Nasi and appointed Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, the young rabbi, also young, 18 years old, to be Nasi. That we had seen a few weeks ago. So now we have, let's review, Hillel and Shammai, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's disciple, Rabbi Eliezer ben Hurkanus and Rabbi Yeshua. And from Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua, we reach Rabbi Akiva. Now, Rabbi Akiva had many students, but most of his students passed away. The Talmud doesn't give us details as to why they passed away. And one theory says that they passed away because Rabbi Akiva was a big believer in Bar Daroma, the great warrior who came from the south. And Rabbi Akiva gave him the nickname Bar Kochva, son of the star, because Rabbi Akiva believed that he would be the Messiah. And so Rabbi Akiva encouraged his students to join the forces of Bar Kochva. And we know that Bar Kochva's forces were destroyed by the Romans. So one theory says that that's when Rabbi Akiva's disciples passed away. And that's why the Talmud doesn't give us much details about it, because the Talmud didn't want to reveal that the rabbis had backed the rebellion against the Romans, because the rabbis were scared for their own lives. So the rabbis had to hide it in the Talmud.
This is the Talmud Yerushalmi. Because by the time the Talmud died, it was around the Roman Empire to fall apart.
Well,
it split apart.
That's what?
It already split into Byzantine and the West.
So. I don't know, but even what the Talmud Bavli quotes, it's quoting things that were said earlier. Meaning the Talmud Bavli is a redaction. It's a quote. It's not. It wasn't said at that time. So it could be that the Talmud Bavli is quoting that. And don't forget that we have a history of rebelling against whoever's in power here in Israel. And that's really what happened in the destruction of the first temple. And that's what brought about the destruction of the second temple. So the rabbis might have been scared to record such thing because why is it that we were given permission by Darius to build the second temple and then he retracted that permission because the Shomronim, the Samaritans living in Israel, sent him word and said, hey, open the history books. Anytime they built fortification, the next thing they did was rebel against the ruling power. Don't let them finish building their temple. And he bought into it. That's Ahasuerus, right? The whole story of Purim. Ahasuerus said, I'm not letting you build the temple. You could have up to half my kingdom, he tells his favorite wife, but you're not going to rebuild that temple. So it could be that even if the immediate threat of the Roman Empire wasn't present, and I'm not sure you're right, that goes back to the discussion of the 260 years that are missing from the Jewish calendar. We had a whole class on that, but there seems to be a contradiction between our tradition as to when the destruction took place and when the history books that were found in Persia and all the history books that they have to date, they seem to indicate that it was 260 years later, the destruction of the temple, and we discussed that there are 260 years missing there might be 260 years missing from the Jewish calendar, so that would also have an impact on what you're saying, depending on who's off by 260 years, us or the Gregorian calendar. But at any rate, coming back to this, so that's one theory that was proposed by Rav Henkin, and I think Rav Israeli also.
Where did the theory that they were arguing between them?
The Gemara says that God sent a plague that wiped out those tens of thousands of students, 24,000, because they didn't treat one another with enough respect. That's what the Gemara says. Question: what does that mean? Suddenly plague, 24,000 people drop dead? So, yeah, the simple understanding is that's what happened. But others want to say that there was more to it than that.
24,000 in the plague this last week's part, though?
Yeah, in Tanakh we find that. But to say that happened in the period of the end of the Second Temple, that's a little bit more difficult. So, we're continuing. We went from Hillel and Shammai to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai to Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Eliezer. Anytime we have Rabbi Yeshua in the Mishnah and Rabbi Eliezer in the Mishnah, it's a reference to Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananiah and Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus. And then we went to Rabbi Akiva, and we said Rabbi Akiva had all these tens of thousands, 24,000 students who all died. And then Rabbi Akiva maintained the oral law with the last five students, which we're about to encounter now, one of which was Rabbi Meir. So now we're going to continue. The Rav Shira Gaon is telling us, and we're expanding on Rabbi Meir. And just to remind ourselves, who is Rabbi Meir? We said the famous story about Rabbi Meir, his father-in-law, right? Who remembers his father-in-law? Rabbi Hanina ben Tradion, who was murdered by the Roman Emperor. He was one of the Asara Arugei Malchus. We discussed Rabbi Meir's wife, Bruria, and the famous stories of her wisdom. We discussed Rabbi Meir's Rebbe, Elisha ben Avuya, Acher. These are things we discussed the last few weeks. We discussed the story about how when Elisha ben Avuya's father gave him his bris milah, so he invited all the rabbis in, and they were sitting down learning, and he saw miraculous things when they were learning, and he said, I want my son to be able to do things like that. And they said, if rabbis can do things like that, I want that. And he pushed his son to learn Torah, but it was really for external purposes. And his son really, we discussed the different Gemaras about why his son left the faith. He was a great, great rabbi, and he left the faith. And we discussed the stories about how Rabbi Meir was once following Acher, and Acher was riding a horse on Shabbos, which is prohibited. And Acher suddenly told him, hey, Rabbi Meir, stop. This is still here. You're allowed to walk on Shabbos. And we discussed the implications of that and why Acher didn't do tshuva. So all of this we've discussed the last few weeks. Now we're up to the recounting of why Rabbi Meir's version of the Mishnah was chosen. We had mentioned in earlier weeks that there were 13 different versions of Mishnah in Rebbe's time, that it was boiled down to 13. We had discussed that Shammai and Hillel had done an editing job, and they had boiled it down to 600 tractates. And now Rebbe is going to do another editing job, and he's going to choose out, sitting down with his court, taking advantage of the peace that was at that time because of the good relationship between him and Antoninus. So now Rebbe is choosing Rabbi Meir's version. So why does Rebbe choose the Mishnah of Rabbi Meir? We say anytime we have a Mishnah and the Mishnah says a law and it doesn't tell us whose opinion it is, it's Rabbi Meir's opinion. Stamat nitin Rabbi Meir. And the reason is that Rabbi Meir had mastered Rabbi Akiva's way of learning, and Rabbi Meir had formulated a version of Mishnah which was not only exact and precise, but it didn't have any extra words. Anyone who learns Gemara sees how the Gemara points out, this word is in the Mishnah to teach me this, and that word is in the Mishnah to teach me that. Well, no one could do, most people couldn't write a Mishnah that way. Rabbi Meir was exceptional in that he could be exacting in every word that he said and every example that he gave in the Mishnah, that you could really derive everything from each word he said. That was a special feat. Even the rabbis in Rabbi Meir's time couldn't do it. Rabbi Meir was exceptional. And he had perfected the learning that he had learned by Rabbi Akiva, and he had put together this exact Mishnah, and that's why Rebbe chose his Mishnah. Now, the Gemara tells us, and those of you who are taking notes should write this down, that any time we have a Mishnah, Stamat Nitin, that's Rabbi Meir. Anytime we have a Tosefta, now what's a Tosefta? So, Rav Shergon isn't explaining it here, but we have other sources that tell us that when Rebbe boiled down the Mishnah, what Rebbe did was he took the Mishnahs that Shammai and Hillel had edited. Remember, there were many, many Mishnahs floating it around. Shammai and Hillel boiled it down to certain Mishnahs, that they verified their sources. Came along Rebbe and boiled it down to less Mishnahs. Well, what happened with all the Mishnahs that were in Shammai and Hillel's tractates? So those became the Tosefta, the added quotes. Anything that's not in the Mishnah is external to the Mishnah. It's called the Braisa. Vara in Aramaic means external. Right? Milibar, externally. So Braisa is the quote that's external. It's external to the Mishnah. Now Braisa is an encompassing term. It encompasses every Tanakh quote that's external to the Mishnah. But those that were included in Shammai and Hillel's edition and excluded from Rebbe's edition, those became the Tosefta. Now, we see clear references in the Mishnayot that the Mishnayot had been much broader. You have the first Mishnah in Pesachim, begins with a discussion, Heichan Amhu, where did the rabbi say that you have to check two rows of barrels, right? The Mishnah is discussing, I have to do Bdikas Chametz, I have to check for the Chametz, where do I have to check? So the Mishnah says you have to check in your wine cellar as well. And then the Mishnah says, and where did the rabbi say that you have to check two rows? So then the Mishnah goes on to explain it's a specific type of wine cellar. This is the first Mishnah. The rabbis haven't yet told me I have to check two rows. What's the Mishnah referring to? And the Mishnah tells me, what did the rabbis mean when they said? They haven't yet said it. So this Mishnah wasn't the first Mishnah in the original text of the Mishnah. There had been a Mishnah preceding it, which said, and the rabbis told us you have to check two rows in a wine cellar. And then came along this Mishnah and said, and where did the rabbis, and which type of wine cellar did they mean? You have to check two rows. And then the Mishnah expounded on the Machlokas, B'Shammai and B'Hillel. What did the rabbis mean? So Rebbe took Rabbi Meir's version, which boiled it down and took out that original Mishnah. Because when you read a sentence that says, and where did the rabbis mean two rows? So you automatically infer, you understand that they once said two rows. But in our Mishnah it doesn't say that. And so too we find other references in the Mishnah that are alluding to things that had been the original text of the Mishnah, but are not in our text, are not in the boiled down version of Rabbi Meir's, and that's the version that Rebbe chose. So again, we're going through it. Anytime we have a Stamat Nitin, a Mishnah that's said plainly, that's Rabbi Meir. Stam Tosefta, a Tosefta that's said plainly, that's Rabbi Nechemya. These are all disciples of Rabbi Akiva. These are the last disciples. Stam Sifra, Rabbi Yehuda. We know we have Sifra de Beirav, that's the Torah's Kohanim. The Gemara says that one of the rabbis once said, I walked into the Beis Medrash over here, and I heard one of the rabbis recounting the Torah like Moses recounted it from God. He means that our Mishnah is case-oriented. You guys with me? Let's expand on that. If I want to tell you the laws of the Torah, I could do it in two ways. I could say, this verse says this, from this verse I derive the following laws. That's verse-driven. I could say, like our Mishnah does, I'll give you a case, I'll tell you the law in that case, and from that case you'll be able to derive it. So I'm going to take a very convoluted case. I'm going to take a case Let's say a person shoots an arrow and that arrow hits a palm tree and knocks down a date, and that date hits a kid on the head, and the kid starts screaming and he scares the guy in front of him, who jumps and throws what he's holding out of his hand, and it bashes. Okay, so now wait a second. That's a very convoluted case. I shot an arrow. The arrow hit the date tree. The date that fell from the date tree hit the baby. The baby started wailing. The wailing caused the guy to throw the thing out of his hand. Now am I responsible or not? Am I responsible for the damage to the date tree? Am I responsible for the damage to the baby? Am I responsible for the damage that the baby caused? So you understand that when I give you such a convoluted case and I give the details of what I'm responsible for, when you'll have a more simple case, you're going to be able to know what the law is. And that's the idea of the Mishnah. The Mishnah is not looking to give me the most common case. The Mishnah is looking to give me a case that can happen, but a case that's going to teach me as many laws as possible. So I could have a Mishnah that says, what happens if you have a fire, and on your fire you have a cake, and a dog comes and takes that cake with a coal and drops it on someone else's pile of grain, burns down that pile of grain, and burns. How much do you have to pay? Who has to pay? The one who made the fire, the one whose dog it is. And then the Mishnah goes through the difference between where the dog placed down the burning coal and where the fire spread. So when the Mishnah tells me in these few words the laws in that case, I will know what responsibility I have for my animal, what responsibility I have for my fire, what responsibility I have when my fire expands and damages. Am I completely liable regardless of what happens? What happens if a person has a fire breakout in his home? So how responsible is he? By giving us a convoluted case, the Mishnah teaches us what would be the laws in far more simple cases. So the Mishnayot were case-driven. Because everything was memorized, even though everyone had in their attic, they had a written down version of what they had memorized, what's called Megillat Sfarim. But in order to teach us as many possible laws from each Mishnah, the rabbis composed the Mishnah in a fashion which was case-driven, giving us a case from which we could derive as many laws as possible. So this was the way they were accustomed to learning. Along came Rav Hoshaya, and he composed the laws verse-driven. He started reading the Torah and said, this verse teaches me this law, and this law, and the other law. Continued reading another verse and quoted all the laws that come out from that verse. Now that was something we weren't accustomed to. When Moshe taught the Torah, so that's how Moshe taught it. Moshe taught us the written law, and word by word, he kept telling us, and what we derived from this are the following oral laws. But the rabbis, in memorizing it, changed it to being case-driven. So then, when we have the composition of the Medrashei Halacha, the Midrashim that teaches the Halachos, and they are verse-driven, that's a new invention, so to speak. It's not really a new invention, that's the way it was originally, but that's what we call, that's the Sifra and Sifri. The Sifra, so when the Sifra was composed, when we have a Sifra without an opinion, it doesn't tell us anyone's opinion, so then that's the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda. Stam Sifri is the Medrash Halacha on the books of Bamidbar and Dvarim, so that's Rabbi Shimon, the Chulu Aliva de Rabbi Akiva, and all of them go with the opinion of Rabbi Akiva, because all these people were disciples of Rabbi Akiva. And here we see a tremendous point, that all of the oral law rests on Rabbi Akiva's shoulders. All of the texts that we have in the Mishnah, the oral law, be it the Mishnah, Tosefta, Safra, Sifri, all of these are Rabbi Akiva's disciples. And if we want to take it one step further, then we could say that all of the oral law rests on the shoulders of a woman. Because why did Rabbi Akiva start his learning? Because of his wife. Because of Yael. So that's what they say, that all of our oral law rests on the shoulders of a woman. What about all the other brisos? Now, before we continue, we should just make a point. The Torah tells us, we say in Kriyat Shema, yeah.
One question.
You're ahead of me. Yeah.
Now, is it possible to understand how much or if anything got lost on the way? As it was developed, were there certain laws they basically after a certain time they excluded it from.
There were definitely things that were lost. We see that in the tractate of Eduyot, there are things that the rabbis thought one way, thought the other way, and then along came in two weavers from Shaar HaShpot in Jerusalem, and they said, "We'll testify before you. We heard from Shemaiah and Avtalion that the law is this way." So until these two weavers came in, Shammai thought this way, Hillel thought that way, and they were both mistaken. The two weavers came in and they gave testimony a third way, which was different than both of them, and we rule like those two weavers. So we see that things were lost. Not a lot, but things were definitely lost.
When was the last time something was changed?
Things are constantly lost. Things are constantly lost. Every generation that goes on, there's a famous story. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky was sitting on the plane, and next to him was sitting a person on his way to the atheist convention in Europe. And they both had their grandchildren sitting next to them. And Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky's grandson, I don't remember the name, Rav Pesen Zatzal told me the exact name of the atheist he was sitting next to, I forgot the name. So Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky's grandson kept bringing him, offering him to eat, offering him if he could help him with something. And this other guy's grandson was busy doing his own thing. So halfway through the flight, the atheist turns to Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky and he asks him, he says, "I don't understand. How do you guys do? Why is it that your grandson treats you with such respect and my grandson, he doesn't?" So Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky told him, "Well, I'll tell you, there's an integral difference in the education that we give our grandchildren and our children as opposed to what you teach your grandchildren and children. When I teach my grandson, I tell him all of the Torah was given at Sinai. And at Sinai we had complete clarity. And every generation that gets more distance from Sinai has a little bit less clarity because he's getting it from someone else who got it from someone else who got it from someone else. You have one more generation from Sinai." That's why, by the way, our sages taught us that if one can learn with his grandson Torah, then he's doing more than if his own father taught him Torah. We value grandparents giving their children more than parents giving their children. A parent has the primary responsibility of chinuch, of educating his child, and nonetheless, wherever the grandparent can help, we value that a lot. So Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky told him, "When my grandson looks at me, he says, 'Boy, he's one generation closer to the source. He's closer than me and closer than my father to Sinai.' So he values that. He respects that. You tell your grandson, you tell him that the world's constantly evolving and improving. Began with monkeys, and every generation gets better. So when he looks at you, he thinks you're one generation closer to a monkey." So he doesn't think he has to respect that. Now, if you think about it, there's depth to that. And that answers an important question. We see today that the world has advanced a lot. In every science, we understand far more today than we did even 5 years ago. You take medicine. Doctors have to buy new textbooks. My brother, I asked him for his textbooks on medicine. I have to read something in the bathroom. So he told me, "No problem." He says, "Every few years they come out with new textbooks that he has to get updated. So he could send me his textbook from 5 years ago because he's not using it anymore." Medicine evolves. And it evolves at such a pace that if you want to be on top of things, so you have to know what the medical journals say today. It's not enough to know what they said a year ago or even half a year ago. So every science is evolving and advancing. You come to Torah, suddenly we find we have questions like we never had before. You find that once upon a time a rabbi would write a book. He'd write a book on 100 mitzvot. Today they write on one detail of one mitzvah. You could have a book this thick with all the details. That doesn't stem from clarity. It stems from lack of clarity. So how is it that when we come to Torah, we find ourselves struggling to get clarity and not getting it? And when it comes to every other science, we gain more clarity. And the reason is this that Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky told him. That when it comes to every other science, we begin with knowing nothing. And when you begin with knowing nothing, so every generation builds on what the previous generation knew. So you're always advancing. You always gain more knowledge. You have what everyone else had, and you learn more. When it comes to Torah, so you're trying to recount, we had everything. When Moshe gave us the Torah, he gave us complete clarity. Now to try and get back where we have many generations to make up, every generation gets one generation further, so every generation loses a little bit of clarity. And one of the things that happens is we lose our tradition. We find even Hillel lost part of the tradition. When Pesach fell out on Shabbos, so when Hillel came up and he was Nasi, he had learned in Babylon by the great sages Shemaiah and Avtalion, And when he came to Israel, he started chastising the people. They had questions. They saw only he knew the answer. They appointed him as the chief rabbi. He was the Nasi. So he got up and he gave a speech. And he started chastising them. He said, "You guys are lazy. If you guys would have gotten up like me and traveled out to Babylon and learned by the chief rabbis, you too would know. Why is it that I'm chief rabbi and not you? Because I went out there and I learned by the chief rabbis. And you guys stuck around here." So we have a tradition in Talmud that whenever someone says something that has even slight haughtiness, God takes him to task for it. And even Hillel, who was very, very modest, he was living the life of a pauper. When he got up and gave this speech in public, God held him to task on it. And shortly thereafter, it was Passover, and Passover fell out on the Shabbos. The eve of Passover, when we bring the Paschal offering, was on the Shabbos. So they came and they asked Hillel, "How are we supposed to carry the knives to slaughter the animals? How do we bring them to the temple?" And Hillel said, "Gee, I don't know." And that's a simple halacha. So he says, so they said, "Oh, you don't know?" So he said, "Look, the Jewish people, even though they're not prophets, they're offsprings of prophets. You'll see that every Jew will do what's right." And then the Jews stuck the knives into the wool of the animals, and the animals, as they went up to the temple, they carried the knives with them, and this way they didn't carry the knives. And when Hillel saw that, he remembered. He said, "Yeah, that's really the halacha. I forgot." And we have a tradition that God did that to Hillel on purpose. Because Hillel stood up and chastised the public, so God made him forget something that everyone else knew. Everyone in the crowd knew. Everyone knew how to bring up the knives, and he forgot. So why am I bringing this? Because at the end of the day, his point was valid. The way he said it, he was held to task. But his point was valid. Because no one else went up, they didn't know as much as he knew. And on most questions, they didn't have the answers he had. So he had a much stronger tradition because he went to the chief rabbis to get a strong tradition. But we see that the rest of the people, they lost part of their tradition. They didn't go out to Babylon to learn. And that's one example. We have other examples, but we see that certain amounts were lost. Fine points were lost. And why did Hillel have to? Why did Rebbe have to write down the Mishnah? Because he saw we were losing it. He saw if he doesn't write it down, we'll lose it. So we do lose. Why is it that today we don't have the power they had in the time of the Mishnah, or in the time of the Gemara, or even in the time of the Shulchan Aruch? Because we've lost. We've forgotten. We don't have the understanding they have of the Torah. That's why we don't dare argue on them, because we say they knew better. It's sad that it's that way, but we lose things. That's primarily due to laziness, because we don't put our strength into learning, and also because of nature. We find that each time we went down, it was because of persecution. The Tanaim to Amoraim was because of the persecution of the destruction of the temple. Amoraim to later, so that needs discussion. And Rishonim to Achronim was the Crusades. The period that the difference between Rishonim and Achronim was the Crusades. The Crusades caused us to have a break in our tradition, and that caused us to go down a level. So, B'zachem, we'll continue next week.